Today at Reader's Corner, Larry Tye, author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend.
With everything, it suggests that this guy was a bigger-than-life character and a bigger-than-life storyteller. If you want to write a biography of Satchel Paige, you have to go out and dig through small-town newspapers all across America and talk to as many living witnesses about what he had done. It was extraordinary. He could pitch underhand, overhand, and sidearm with a single windup or triple windmill windup. He could, most importantly, make that ball go as hard and fast as anybody ever had and just where he wanted it. And for all of that, it's a medical miracle.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Baseball season is upon us, another reminder of the role baseball legends play in our country's collective heart. Dizzy Dean, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, and Hank Aaron are still household names generations after their feats on the baseball diamond made them famous. But perhaps none represents the promise and hard truths of the American experience during baseball's golden age better than pitching great Satchel Paige. Larry Tye is the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, and today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Tye. His book has been called a biography of two American icons, Satchel Paige, arguably the greatest pitcher ever to throw a baseball, and Jim Crow, the amalgam of Southern laws that mandated separation of the races everywhere from public bathrooms to schools and buses. Satchel was named a New York Times notable book and won the Casey Award and the Seymour Medal as the best baseball book. Larry Tye has been a prize-winning journalist at the Boston Globe and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He now runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists. Mr. Tye joins us by phone for this interview. Larry Tye, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be on with you.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Leroy Robert Paige. How does a young black man growing up in the South and playing baseball get a name like Satchel?
With every story with Satchel, there are several versions. There was his favorite version, which is when he was a young kid, when he was sort of old enough to be out of the house on his own, he, like all of his 11 brothers and sisters, had to go out and help do what they could to put food on the table. And in his case, that meant going down to the local L&N train station there in Mobile and carting bags around like a pint-sized Pullman porter. And he says that he learned that carrying a bag a dime at a time didn't earn him nearly enough money, so he hooked up a system of ropes and pulleys that would let him carry 3 to 4 bags at once. And a buddy looked at him carrying all these suitcases and said, "You look like a walking satchel tree," and that the name stuck. Now, that's his version. His buddy Wilbur Hines, who grew up with him in Mobile, said it wasn't because he was carting around suitcases, but because he was stealing them that he got dubbed Satchel. So with everything with Satchel, there are various versions, and with everything, it suggests that this guy was a bigger-than-life character and a bigger-than-life storyteller.
Well, from looking at the size of your book, and especially the end of the book, the notes, the bibliography, you managed to get just about every version of every aspect of Satchel's life. First of all, how did you happen upon Satchel? What caused you to make this effort? How long did it take? And tell us a little bit about how you went about getting all this information.
Sure. Let me start out with why I picked Satchel as a topic. Everybody is always looking for a little story to tell a much bigger story through. And to me, Satchel's life was the narrow lens to look at the bigger issue of Jim Crow America, America during the era of racial segregation. His life began at the very moment in Mobile, Alabama, when the Jim Crow laws were displacing the old system of Reconstruction tolerance, and he takes us right up to the point of integration in America. And I had heard when I was a kid going to Boston Red Sox games with my dad, every time a really good pitcher took the mound, my dad compared him to Satchel Paige. And my father, like most white Americans in that era, only knew about the legend of Satchel Paige, but the legend was enormous enough that he became the touchstone of which you compared all the great pitchers. 30 years later, when I was writing a book on these elegant men who worked on the railroads called Pullman porters, who worked on George Pullman sleeping cars, they reminded me about Satchel Paige, and they had carried every prominent African-American of that era, from Joe Louis to Louis Armstrong to Paul Robeson, and their favorite by far was Satchel Paige. So it started out with my dad. It continued with the Pullman Porters. It fit my bill of trying to tell this big story of racial segregation through the very dramatic and sensational life of Satchel Paige, and so it was a natural for me to want to do. The tougher issue was how you do it. That Satchel grew up in an era, he played most of his baseball in the shadow world of the Negro Leagues, where there were few, if any, reporters covering his games. And so it made it a challenge. If you want to write a book about Babe Ruth or Mickey Mantle, there were a million press accounts of everything they did. If you want to write a biography of Satchel Paige, you had to go out and dig through small-town newspapers all across America and talk to as many living witnesses about what he had done. And I spent two wonderful years doing that, traveling everywhere Satchel had traveled, talking to friends and relatives, talking to old Negro leaguers and major leaguers who had played with him. I talked to 200 or so people in all, and I didn't believe any story until I started hearing it a second and a third time, and that's when I believed that I really could try to separate the legend of Satchel Paige from who the guy really was. And I also understood going through that process why there were a dozen or more biographies, major biographies, of Ruth and Mantle, of DiMaggio and Cobb, but why there were very few, if any, books about the great Satchel Paige.
You mentioned that your dad, sitting in Red Sox Stadium, talked about Satchel, but would not have been able to see him to pitch. Obviously, Satchel was pitching in the Negro Leagues in the South, as you had said. Did Southern whites ever see Satchel Paige pitch? Did Southern whites go to Negro League games in those days?
It's a good question, and the answer is only in the later years. Satchel started out in the mid-1920s, and in that era and throughout the early 30s, whether he was pitching in Chicago or Birmingham or Baltimore, it was mainly African-Americans who went to see him. That started to change in the mid-30s. Satchel started to pitch so sensationally that he attracted the attention first of white sports writers, writing everywhere from the New York Times to Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. And then he started attracting white fans. And by the early 40s, he was attracting enough white fans that that's what helped white owners see that black ball players could not only be playing great baseball for them, but they could be attracting black fans and white ones and put money in their pockets. And I think that's what changed baseball from being a segregated sport to being an integrated one, the prospect of owners earning big money.
When you finished all of your research and started writing the book, was there anything about that learning experience that really surprised you? You thought you knew everything there was to know about Satchel Paige, and whoa, did I learn something I was totally unaware of?
Yeah, I learned a number of things about him that to me were surprising. One, I learned that his legend, these extraordinary stories about pitching 2,500 games and winning 2,000 and pitching dozens of shutouts and no-hitters, I thought that they were mainly going to be fabricated, and probably 80% of them turned out to be true. I learned that Satchel was every bit as much of a character in his personal life, that at one point he had two wives. He traveled the country, and everywhere he went, he left in his wake, he left huge stories, and huge stories that were mainly true about the things he had done, his prodigious Babe Ruth-like appetites. But what was, I guess, most surprising was I learned that this guy, who was a brilliant storyteller and who always seemed to be in the center of a crowd, that he was actually a pretty shy and lonely guy. And the only place that he preferred to be, if he wasn't going to be in the center of a crowd, sort of having people listen to his stories, his favorite place to be was all by himself at a watering hole by the side of the road where he could pull out his fishing rod and catch catfish on his own. That as much as he enjoyed sort of having people listen to his stories and regaling them, he really enjoyed being on his own or being with his kids or being with maybe one friend or one girlfriend.
You know, you mentioned, I think you estimated in your book that he threw, again, there were no radar guns in those days, but there's estimates between 100 and 105 miles an hour. Today, when we watch baseball, if we see something in the high 90s, we're really impressed. Every now and then, a reliever or a closer will come in and he'll get clocked at 100 just because he's only thrown three or four pitches. With Satchel, I guess it raises the issue of what many have said over the years, was he the greatest pitcher ever to play baseball? How do you come away with an answer to that after writing your book?
Well, I come away with two answers. First, to the question of just how fast and how hard he could throw. Rather than trusting to radar guns, I trusted two things. One, I trusted Bob Feller, who was his teammate in Cleveland when Satchel first made it to the majors. And Feller is the kind of guy who generally says nice things, mainly about himself. And he thinks that Satchel was throwing 100 miles an hour. I can also trust to his catchers, who say that Satchel was throwing so hard and fast that in order for them to feel like they still had a hand left at the end of a game that they caught him, they had to put a beefsteak in between their glove and their hand. That was the only way they could really provide enough cushioning. And in terms of just how good he was, and there are lots of baseball writers and fans who know the game a lot better than me, I trust that I can say this without anybody being able to contradict it, that nobody in the history of baseball threw better for longer than Satchel Paige. He might well have been the best ever at any given moment in the height of his career, but nobody pitched for the 40 years in professional baseball like Satchel did. He set a record when he came to the major leagues and pitched his last game. He set a record that will never be broken. When he pitched three innings for Charlie Finley's A's in 1965, three shutout innings against the Boston Red Sox, he was 59 years, 2 months, and 8 days old. That's a record which we can't say about many records in baseball. It's a record that will never be broken.
You're listening to Larry Tye. He's the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, the story of the baseball pitcher, Satchel Paige. Here's the thing that really gets me about what you've just said about his record, about his speed, and his control. I'm looking at the first photo in the middle of your book that you've provided us that shows the classic Paige pitching pose. And his leg, as you describe it, is high enough to black out the sky. But what's really interesting is that his right arm and his hand, which is holding the ball, appears to be no more than a foot to 18 inches off the ground. So he's balancing himself on his right leg, his left leg, way up in the air. And then he's going to come all the way around and throw that ball and pinpoint it right over a matchbook on the plate, as he often did before games. To have that kind of control with that kind of a weird windup, I assume if Paige came back from the dead and stepped out there on the pitcher's mound today, anybody in baseball would distinguish it from the raft of pitchers who take the mound today, wouldn't you think?
You're exactly right, and you described it really well. It was somehow being able to do the balancing act, somehow being able to take his long arms and wiry body and get the most kinetic energy he could out of it. It was extraordinary. He could pitch underhand, overhand, and sidearm. He could pitch with a single windup or triple windmill windup. He could, most importantly, make that ball go as hard and fast as anybody ever had and just where he wanted it. And for all of that, it's a medical miracle.
Tell us about the stall. I thought that was really fascinating. I didn't know about that.
His so-called hesitation pitch, and it was really quite extraordinary, is what he learned as a kid in Mobile when his gang, his all-black gang, would have to make it through territory controlled by white gangs, and they would throw rocks at one another. And he learned that if I'm throwing a rock at you and I wind up and throw it, you can time it so that you can duck, and chances are 9 out of 10 times I'm going to miss you. But he learned if he hesitated exactly before the point of release that the guy would duck and that he could actually get him as a sitting duck in just the position he wanted him and hit him 10 out of 10 times. And he learned how to do that as a kid throwing rocks. He did it when he was a major leaguer, and everybody from Yogi Berra to Casey Stengel were sort of in awe of it. And as I say, sometimes the umpires called it a balk, and other times they just called it an extraordinary pitch and let him get away with it.
I mentioned the matchbook on the plate. I didn't do a very good job of explaining that. Tell us how Satchel used to warm up and what his motives probably were.
What he was trying to do, he understood in his early years in the Negro Leagues that the black fans who were coming out to see him didn't have a whole lot of money, and he was going to give them a show before the game even started. So what he would do is he would set up this tiny paper matchbook on home plate. He'd walk 60 feet 6 inches back to the pitcher's mound, and he'd proceed to throw 9 out of 10 pitches directly over that matchbook at 90 to 100 miles an hour. And he did it for two reasons. One, as I say, was to put on a show for fans before the game. The other was for any opponent who might have been there early watching what he was doing, seeing what he could do throwing it over this matchbook, had them having second and third thoughts when they stood up against him in the batter's box. They thought anybody who was that good was somebody who was going to be really difficult to hit against, and it was the perfect intimidation factor that he was looking for.
You call him a barnstorming pitcher, and what's interesting about reading this bio of his is that, in a sense, he was a free agent before free agency even existed. He was bouncing around all over the place, and he was playing for one team and would sometimes go off and play for another. How did that work?
It worked that he was out there trying to make a living with his pitching, and people on the one hand who brought him in, the owners, the general managers of these teams, hated the idea that he would skip from one team to the other and that he would honor a contract only when it served his purposes to do it. On the other hand, they knew he could fill the stadium. They knew he was a crowd draw like nobody else. And so they would watch him break a contract, and they'd still take him back whenever he would come back to pitch for them. And he was extraordinary enough that even if you could only bring him in for one night, like the New York Black Yankees did when they would rent out Yankee Stadium, they knew there was a whole lot of money on the line, that they were paying the white owners of the Yankees a lot of money to rent their stadium, and they had to be guaranteed of a sellout crowd, and Satchel was the one guy to do it. So they might pay him $500, they might pay him as much as $1,000, which was huge money back then, to come in and pitch that one night, because he could put fans in those seats.
And he took white ball players along with him, like Dizzy Dean and Joe DiMaggio, is that right?
He did. They had wonderful barnstorming tours across the country. He did it for several months against Dizzy Dean and his All-Stars. He did it years later in the 1940s against Bob Feller and his All-Stars. They traveled to small towns all across America. It was extraordinary the way that they could have white and black players playing on the same field, and nobody complained because it was brilliant baseball.
Probably the most fascinating part of your book for me, Larry, is when you get into the Jackie Robinson story, because, of course, the Jackie Robinson story is told from a very white perspective. And when you hear it today, whenever you hear it, every year now that everybody wears 42, it's always told from the perspective of the majority white. Having you tell it from the vantage point of a Satchel Paige, and you quoted a Negro leaguer who really summed it up in your book. You say, Jackie Robinson opened the door to the new racial reality, but as one veteran Negro leaguer said, it was Satchel who inserted the key. That relationship between Satchel and Robinson, Branch Rickey, was a very complex one, and I wonder if you could help us understand how Satchel dealt with the fact that he was not the first Negro asked to come up into the major leagues.
He started out with the perfect politically correct answer when reporters asked him what he thought about Jackie's signing. He said, you couldn't have picked a better guy, Jackie's the guy. But when he said that, he had to be having heartburn, because that's not what he believed. What he really believed was that it should have been him. And I think he believed that with a lot of justification. It was Satchel who brought the attention of the white press and white fans to the fact that there was such a thing called the Negro Leagues. It was Satchel who drew the attention of Branch Rickey of the Brooklyn Dodgers to the all-black Kansas City Monarchs, where Satchel was a star. And it was because of Satchel that Branch Rickey found out about this guy who started that season in 1945 as the Monarchs' rookie second-string second baseman, a guy named Jackie Robinson. Satchel had been around taking crap from people for a full generation before Jackie showed up in the world, and so Satchel thought that he should have been the one to break the barrier.
And you seem to imply, maybe it's more than an implication, that Jackie Robinson never really handled that issue of the Negro Leagues very well himself. He was pretty much focused on himself. He was kind of a dour guy. He wasn't the showman that Satchel was, and never, at least as far as some of the Negro Leaguers are concerned, never gave enough credit to the folks who came before him and made him possible.
I think that's true. I think that Jackie had this sense that he had done it more on his own than he had. He only spent that one season in 1945 in the Negro Leagues. He thought that guys like Satchel were old hat. They might be step and fetchets, if not Uncle Toms. And he thought that he represented sort of what they called in those days the new Negro, the sense of where blacks were going in terms of self-advancement. And I think he was a bit too quick to dismiss all the people upon whose shoulders he stood. It wasn't just Satchel Paige. It was the great slugger. They called him the Black Babe Ruth, Josh Gibson. It was the guy who may have been the fastest man in baseball, Cool Papa Bell. It was a whole series of players who from the 1900s, earliest 1900s, all the way through the mid-century, those were the guys who set the tone. And as you said, it was Jackie who opened the door, but Satchel and all those others had definitely inserted the key.
You're listening to Larry Tye, author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Now, looking at it from Branch Rickey's standpoint, the guy who, of course, made the big move to bring Jackie Robinson into the major leagues, he's looking for a guy who's not going to rock the boat and make any waves. And so there is a side to this story that perhaps Satchel was a little bit too out in front, perhaps too aggressive, and that he wanted a guy like Jackie. Is there some truth to that?
All of those things that you said about Satchel are true, and that is absolutely why the conservative, teetotaling Branch Rickey wanted Jackie. Jackie was a college guy. He had lettered in four sports. He was, most importantly, a young guy who would do what Rickey told him to do and say what Rickey told him to say. Satchel never did what anybody told him to do, never said what anyone told him to say. To me, that's a brilliant reason why Satchel would have been even better than Jackie. He wouldn't have had the ulcers that Jackie did. Satchel knew what it was like for fans to yell racist remarks, and Satchel had learned how to charm white fans during half a century that he played. And I think he would have been able to go out there the way he actually did finally in 1948 when he was brought up by Bill Veeck to the Cleveland Indians. He would have gone out there and set records in every stadium he played in because people like my dad knew about Satchel Paige. And they had to learn about Jackie Robinson, and Satchel would have had fun with it. And I'm not sure Jackie ever had fun.
You know, I never really thought until I read your book about the implications of Branch Rickey taking Jackie Robinson, Robinson breaking into the major leagues, and the impact that that had on the business of the Negro Leagues. Because if I understand it right, that was really the beginning of the end for the Negro Leagues, wasn't it?
It was the beginning of the end for a number of reasons. One, it was the beginning of the end because they watched their great players going off to play in the major leagues. You know, the best of the Negro Leagues, after Jackie, everybody was getting signed. Another reason was because they watched black fans want to go to the major league games instead of the Negro League games, and white fans too, because that's where they could watch these great black stars. And they watched an institution, you know, segregation produce lots of evil in America, and the whole system is something that we look back on with great regret. On the other hand, we can't forget that segregation also produced brilliant institutions, and the all-black school, the Negro Leagues, these were institutions that were at the center of black culture in America from the end of Reconstruction through the mid-1900s, and there was a sense of loss along with gain when baseball became integrated. On a Sunday afternoon, in Chicago or Detroit, in Birmingham or Baltimore, the place to be for those 50 years in the first half of the 20th century was at a Negro League ball game. Women saved their best clothes and spent a week getting their hair ready to go to those games. Men put on their straw hats and their patent leather shoes. Ministers let out church early, not just so that their congregants could make it on time to the game, but so that they could. That was where you wanted to be, and it was sad to see it die.
And boy, you know, if you watch Ken Burns' series on baseball, that's one of the things that really struck me, to see the way people dressed up for baseball. All the men, coats and ties and hats, and all the ladies in their hats and their finest Sunday dresses. Baseball games are sure a lot different today, but that's another story. So Jackie Robinson hits the majors. Before you know it, other black ball players are following him, including Satchel Paige, who goes into the majors at the age of 42 years old, the oldest man ever to debut in the major leagues, and he ends up becoming Rookie of the Year that year. How did he stack up in the majors that year and then in subsequent years?
In that year, he was great. He was brought in by a guy who was willing to take a chance, Bill Veeck, owner of Cleveland Indians. He's brought in the middle of what may have been the tightest pennant race in the history of baseball. It was the Cleveland Indians against the Boston Red Sox, New York Yankees, and Philadelphia Athletics. And they were going neck and neck in the middle of that summer. So on Satchel's 42nd birthday, Veeck signs him to his first major league contract. Satchel goes on to pitch to a 6-1 record, second lowest ERA in the major leagues, in the American League that season. And most importantly, he helped lead Cleveland, not just to the pennant, but Cleveland ended up winning the World Series that year. He came through in a huge way for Veeck, enough so that 12 sports writers, when they were picking their choice for the Associated Press Sports Rookie of the Year, 12 of them named Satchel, to which Satchel brilliantly said, "I'm delighted at what the gentleman did, but I'm not quite sure what year they're talking about."
Well, let's fast forward to Satchel Paige getting inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame and the particular incident about where his plaque would hang. And most importantly, share with us how conflicted he seemed to be, not knowing really whether to pay homage to the Hall of Fame for letting him in or whether to look back on all those years wondering what he could have been had he been able to play in the majors a lot sooner.
Yes, you've said it well. It's the same push-pull that Satchel had throughout his career. On the one hand, he was delighted when he had opportunities. On the other hand, he was resentful for all the years that he'd been denied those opportunities. So he gets inducted into the Hall of Fame, and they say, "We're going to put you in here, but we're going to put you in a separate corridor." So they're going to make up for 50 years of segregated baseball by segregating the Hall of Fame. The good news is, after the time that they announced that and before he was actually inducted, fans and sports writers screamed so loudly that they put him right into the center of the Hall of Fame, no segregated corridor. And if you go to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown today, you'll see a brilliant statue of Satchel, left leg kicking up so high into the air that it blocked out the sky, right arm extended forward. He's right there at the entrance to the Hall of Fame, which is just where he belongs.
You know, one of the things that I found so fascinating about your book, these white owners like Bill Veeck and Charlie O'Finley and Bill Bartholomew, they really went out of their way. I think it was Bartholomew that figured out a way to keep him playing ball with Atlanta so he could get his pension. Is that right?
It is right. And Bartholomew said, you know, it would be a disgrace to baseball if we didn't let Satchel Paige get the pension he deserves because he lacked a few months of qualifying time. So we brought him in as a pitching coach and as a just general team mascot almost for the Atlanta Braves when they first moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta. And it ended up that summer. That was when right after Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And that summer was a summer of huge racial tension all across America. And it ended up that Satchel helped keep the peace in Atlanta, which was a dividend that Bartholomew had never expected. And it was brilliant because Satchel was the best-known African-American in Atlanta then, and he did what he always did, which was sort of promote racial reconciliation just by being there and talking to people and having everybody trust him.
Well, Larry, we've used up our time, and we're going to have to close off here, but it's such a great job helping us better understand that era and this very special baseball player. Thank you for joining us today on New Horizons, Larry.
I appreciate you having me on.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Larry Tye. Next week, John Gertner, author of The Idea Factory, Bell Labs, and the Great Age of American Innovation. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.